Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, they were celebrating in the streets of Santo Domingo yesterday after the Dominican Republic beat Puerto Rico in the finals of the World Baseball Classic in San Francisco. The Dominicans were unbeaten with 8 straight victories, becoming the first team ever to win the WBC crown with a perfect record.
They have some great Major League players on that team, including Robinson Cano from the New York Yankees, as well as Miguel Tejada, Hanley Ramirez, and shortstop Jose Reyes, who talked about what the victory meant.
I can't even describe this feeling right now because, like I said before, in Dominican, they were waiting for this moment so bad, and we did it for the whole Dominican Republic, so we win.
Joining us now to talk about that and the rest of the week in sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hey there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
So you hear the excitement from fans and players from the Dominican Republic, but here in the United States, the average baseball fan might have been like, oh, sorry, what World
no,
Baseball
No,
Classic?
No. Here in the United States, the average baseball fan is, let me see those brackets again. This basketball tournament is starting. I got to get some bets now.
Why is that? I mean, it's a huge world event.
Well, March Madness is part of it. There is a bit of a distraction there. I think another part of it is the general managers of the Major League Baseball teams here in the U.S. Have their own idea about what players ought to be doing in March to get ready for the Major League Baseball season, and they impose those ideas on Joe Torre, who is managing the U.S. team, and so he has 30 bosses, and he can't possibly please them all, and so it's tough. It's tough to create a team in that circumstance.
But that apathy seems to be almost uniquely American, because from what I understand, this event is huge in other countries.
It is huge in other countries. You heard how huge it was in the Dominican Republic. It's huge in Puerto Rico, where there is a real effort to re-energize the baseball community, and I've been told that Puerto Rico coming in second has done that, that they're excited and it's worked out. Japan, it's important enough in Japan so the players try out. You don't just show up and say, I want to be on the team the way you do in the U.S. You try out. It's like, you know, Little League. It's important. So, yes, everywhere else, it's a bigger deal than it is here.
Hmm. Now, the U.S. Was knocked out in the second round this year. The team didn't really feature any major stars at all. It's never won the WBC and has reached the semifinals just once. Bill, is there any chance that U.S. baseball organizers will have a change in heart and take this event more seriously in the future?
I don't know if there's a chance that it will happen, but Tom Verducci, writing for Sports Illustrated, made a great suggestion about how to take it more seriously. Mm-hmm. He said the U.S. team in the World Baseball Classic should show up in Florida or Arizona as a team. In other words, it shouldn't be a bunch of players getting into spring training with a bunch of different teams. They should show up as a team. They should create a team unity. I mean, that's so evident with the other teams, the DR, Japan,
idea.
And Puerto Rico. And I don't know. I don't think the general managers would go along with it. I think they're looking forward to the major league season. That's where the money is. That's where the contracts they have with the players and the rest of it. And so this is simply not an important event as far as they're concerned. Not important enough.
Like so many stories in sports and politics, follow the money.
That's it.
All right. Well, speaking of baseball and the love of baseball, you recorded an interview with author W.P. Kinsella, which will air this weekend on Only a Game. Remind us of who Kinsella is and what he's famous for.
Well, Kinsella is probably most famous for writing Shoeless Joe, the novel which was made into Field of Dreams, a very popular movie. He's now 78 years old. And he has a new book out called Butterfly Winter. And when that arrived on my desk, I said, hey, I know we don't usually do novels on Only a Game, but this is an opportunity to talk to W.P. Kinsella, and I think it'll be fun.
Well, Shoeless Joe is a great book. What does he say about the love, his love of baseball?
Well, I asked him that, Anthony, and I asked him specifically to tell me what it was that appealed to him as a writer about baseball.
Well, I suppose it's the open-endedness of the game. Baseball is wide open. If you don't have a fence, the foul lines diverge forever, and there's theoretically no distance a great hitter couldn't hit the ball or a great fielder couldn't run to retrieve it. And, of course, that makes for myth, and it makes for larger-than-life characters.
Hmm. as he said to me, you can't have a larger-than-life hockey player because they're in that little rink and they keep banging into things.
There's only so much room.
Bill, do we get larger-than-life baseball characters in the new novel?
Well, we get much larger-than-life because the two main characters are twins and they start playing catch when they're still in their mother's womb.
Oh.
And so you can't get too much more mythical than that. One of them is a great pitcher. The other is a very good catcher who can't hit, but the pitcher won't pitch to anybody but his brother, so they come as a package deal in the major leagues. It's a great story.
Wow. Well, you can hear more about that this weekend. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, every Saturday at 7 a.m., again at 7 p.m. right here on WBUR. Bill, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Though it may not feel like it, today is the first day of spring. It's been a cabin feverish kind of winter, but in honor of the coming warmth and sun, we thought we'd share a little ramble through nature with you to celebrate all creatures great and small. Really, really, really small. Erin Ellison is a senior research fellow at Harvard and co-author of A Field Guide to the Ants of New England. I took a walk in the woods around Walden Pond with him to discover more about the lowly, lovely ant. So what do we have here? They look like tiny little mounds of dirt.
They look like tiny little mounds of dirt, and in fact, they are tiny little mounds of dirt. One of the things that ants do is they move soil around. People always want to know why ants are important.
Now, you just picked one up off the ground. How do you get it without squashing the poor guy?
Okay, so unlike you and me, ants have exoskeletons, right? They've got their skeleton on the outside, not on the inside. And so when you pick one up, you're just squeezing its exoskeleton.
So they're tougher than we think.
They're a lot tougher than we think. But so back to these mounds of dirt. So we'll put her back down and she'll run away very happily. What ants do, almost all of the ants that we have here in New England, their nests go down below the frost line. So their nests go down 3, 4, 5 feet into the soil.
Oh, so really deep then.
Really deep. And what they do is they're little excavators. And so they're down 3 or 4 feet and they got to dig out space for them to have their brood chambers and their queen chambers and their worker chambers. And the material that they excavate, they have to bring somewhere. And so they bring it up. And where I work out at Harvard Forest, there was a researcher named Walter Lyford back in the 1950s and 60s, and he worked on soil biology. And he estimated from watching ants for a number of years and watching them bring up soil that the ants in our forests probably make about 1 inch of new topsoil by bringing soil up every 200 or so years.
Oh, interesting, of course, because they're digging what's below and cycling it up to the surface.
Cycling it up, exactly. And of course, we don't have any native earthworms in New England. All the earthworms were wiped out by the glaciers. And so any earthworms that we have in New England are things that people have brought in compost or bait or whatever and let go. In many places, this is actually a real problem because these systems evolved without earthworms, and ants were the primary creator of soil. And so all the soil around here that we have essentially that's been created over the last 10 to 15,000 years, the vast majority of that is created by ants. So there are about 122 species here in New England. Here's a bigger one. This is one that almost everyone will know and recognize and is much easier to get a picture
big,
of.
Big, big black ant.
With a gold butt.
I have to say I'm quite impressed by your ant wrangling skills.
So this one, it's large, it's black, it's got a very nice curved back, and if you look at it up close and personal, the tail end of it has really dense, long, golden hairs.
Can I see your head, little? Is this another girl?
They're all girls.
They're all girls.
She's maybe
got,
we'll
does
get
she got
lucky
big,
and we'll
does
see
she have
a
big pincers
there.
On the front?
She has pretty big pincers. They don't do any damage, really. This is the eastern carpenter ant. You want to hold her? Just
so,
grab
okay.
a leg.
So just grab a leg.
Yeah, gently.
Oh, I don't want to break her.
She's trying to take a bite out of my thumb.
Yeah, she is. But you can see it, even though this
it tickles.
It tickles. And this is one of the largest ants we have in New England. The carpenter ants are the biggest ants that we have in New England. And they've got jaws that look like they ought to be able to do something. And they really...
Oh, she's putting up a fight, though. I can feel her pinching my thumb. All right. I'm sorry to have bothered you, but you help us learn a little bit about your colony. How about how many ants would be in a colony beneath our feet?
So a colony of carpenter ants, or a colony of one of those lazy ants, is probably on the order of 10 to 50,000 workers.
Sorry, I'm going to let her go. Don't bite your leg off.
Just drop her down.
You just go. Oops, sorry.
There she goes.
Looks like she was gnawing at her leg.
Yeah, she was trying. She'd take it off so that she could get away.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can get away with all legs, six legs intact.
So here we are at the site of Thoreau's cabin, discovered in 1945. Like they didn't know where it was before that. And so this is pretty interesting. I was actually curious to come out here because in Walden, Thoreau describes a battle between black ants and red ants, and he describes it as having just stepped out of his cabin to his woodpile, and here's his woodshed. So the woodpile can't be very far from where we're standing right now. And so 170 years ago, Thoreau was writing about red ants and black ants battling each other. And if we put this in contemporary terms, what was probably happening was that the red ants were raiding the black ant colony. Uh-huh. Because many species of ants, I don't want to say they're lazy, but they've evolved so that other ant species do their work for them.
It's funny because I think Thoreau in that chapter even uses the word enslavement somewhere. I am curious, though. Okay, so it's not as if ants have individual agencies. They're colony creatures. But
they are colony
how is
creatures.
It that the enslaving ants actually get, or the raiding ants get the other individuals to work for them?
When these slave-making ants collect new slaves, they have to fool them chemically.
Right.
And so they rearranged, essentially, they're blanketing them with chemical signals. It's like chemical warfare, if you want to use a human metaphor.
Just in the few minutes that we've been walking together here at Walden, now I'm never going to go in the woods again, and it won't feel the same walking around thinking about all the millions of ants that are probably just a few feet underground.
The other big important things that ants do is they eat just about everything. They eat dead things, they eat live things, and all around us, all the time, stuff is dying. Yeah. Ants are scavengers. So they find a dead moth or a dead caterpillar, they'll haul it back to the nest and eat it. If we didn't have ants and other decomposers, we would be face deep in carcasses of stuff.
So they are essential recyclers.
They are essential recyclers. It's a really interesting little mushroom coming up here.
So what do you hope people will gather from the field guide?
Well, I guess we hope that people will end up with a lot more appreciation for yet another group of animals that we share the planet with, and then that group of animals that's really important. And you could argue that given what ants do for making soil and for turning over nutrients and for decomposing things, that ants can get along pretty well without people, but people would have a really hard time on this planet getting along without ants.
Well, thank you so much for taking me on this walk in Walden and really opening my eyes to everything that I can't see going on with these ants. Thank you so much.
Carry a loop with you when you go out.
Aaron Ellison is co-author of A Field Guide to the Ants of New England.
Got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on. Got ants in my pants and I need to dance.
And that's our show today. We love hearing from you. Any thoughts you have at all about our program? If you've got something to say, rants, raves, compliments, and criticisms, anything at all, you can always post a comment at radioboston.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. You can reach me at Anthony G. Brooks.
And I'm Meghna WBUR. That's MEGHNAWBUR. That's a Twitter handle again. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.